We can't let them have it, Alina had said of the Shisadu. Jesus, could you have been a little more specific? I muttered. Who shouldn't get it? Even if by some fluke of fate I found the darn thing, not only would I probably not be able to touch it, according to Barons, I wouldn't have any idea what to do with it. I sighed. I had nothing but questions and nobody to ask. I was thick in the middle of people who guarded secrets and pursued hidden agendas as naturally as they lived and breathed and probably killed. Just look at the men I'd met in the past week. McCabe, Malouche, Vlaine, Barons. Not a normal one among them, not a safe one in the bunch. A lamb in the City of Wolves, Barons had called me shortly after we'd met. Which one will take you down, I wonder, he had said. Secrets. Everyone had secrets. Alina had taken hers to the grave. I had no doubt that trying to ask Vlaine questions when I saw the Fae again, I wasn't stupid enough to think it was done with me, would be an exercise in futility. The alleged prince might answer me, but I was only an oop detector, not a lie detector. And Barons was no better. As Fiona's little dispute with him revealed, he was keeping secrets too, and I was somehow in even more danger than I already knew. That was a cheerful thought. As of this morning, I'd pretty much figured out that any time I walked out the door, I was taking my life in my own hands, but apparently I was in danger while I was here, too. God, I was homesick. I missed my life. I missed the brickyard. I missed Saturday night closes with my bartending buddies. I missed our obligatory 3 a.m. huddle house stop for pancakes, where we'd try to unwind enough to sleep before dawn, and in the summer plan what lake to meet at later that day.
"We'll be seeing Rourke O'Banion tomorrow, Miss Lane,"
Barons had told me through my locked and barricaded door when he'd climbed four flights to chew my head off.
"He's the third big player on the field. Among other things, he owns O'Banion's, a posh bar in downtown Dublin. It's old world with wealthy clientele. As you seem to have a problem dressing yourself, Fiona will fetch you appropriate attire. Do not leave the bookstore again without me, Miss Lane."
It was 3 in the morning before I slept, and when I did, it was with the closet door wide open and every single light in the bedroom and adjoining bathroom ablaze. 15. Rourke Rocky O'Banion had been born Irish Catholic, dirt poor, and with genes that would give him the strength, stamina, and body of a prize-fighter before his 18th birthday. With his looks, some would call him Black Irish, but it wasn't Spanish or Melungeon blood in his veins. It was an unspoken of Saudi ancestor that had bequeathed something fierce, dark, and ruthless to the O'Banion line. Born in a city controlled by two feuding Irish crime families, the Hallorans and O'Kearneys, Rourke O'Banion fought his way to the top in the ring, but it wasn't enough for the ambitious champ. He hungered for more. One night when Rocky was 28 years old, the Halloran and O'Kearney linchpins, every son, grandson, and pregnant woman in their families, were killed. 27 people died that night, gunned down, blown up, poisoned, knifed, or strangled. The city had never seen anything like it. A group of flawlessly choreographed killers had closed in all over the city, at restaurants, homes, hotels, and clubs, and struck simultaneously. "Horrific," most said. "Bloody brilliant," some said. "Good riddance," nearly all said, including the cops. The very next day, when a suddenly wealthy Rocky O'Banion, champion boxer and many a young boy's idol, retired from the ring to take over control of various businesses in and around Dublin, previously run by the Hallorans and O'Kearneys, he was hailed by the working-class poor, whose hope and bank accounts were as tiny as their TVs and dreams were big, as a hero, despite the fresh and obvious blood on his hands and the rough pack of ex-boxers and thugs he brought with him. That he was a damned fine-looking man didn't hurt any. Rocky was considered quite the charmer and ladies' man, but one with a fine point of honor that endeared him to his faithful. He didn't sleep with other men's wives, ever. The man who had no respect for life, limb, or law respected the sacraments of marriage. Did I mention he was Irish Catholic? A joke around the city was that the young O'Banion had missed school the day the priest had given the sermon about the Ten Commandments, and on make-up day little Rocky only got the short list. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, but everything else is up for grabs. Despite the colorful background Barons had given me on our soon-to-be third host, and unsuspecting victim, as I was coming to think of them, I would still find myself unprepared for the dichotomies that were Rocky O'Banion. Barons, I said, I really don't think stealing from this guy is a very good idea. I'd seen my share of mafia movies. You didn't march up to the Godfather and rip him off, and expect to survive for very long afterward, anyway. I already had too many scary things after me.
We'll burn that bridge when we come to it, Miss Lane, he replied.
I glanced over at him. My life was so surreal. Tonight, Barons had selected a 1975 Lamborghini Countach, one of only three Wolf Countaches ever made, from his absurd collection. I think the expression is cross that bridge, Barons, not torch it. What do you want? Every freak, vampire, fae, and mafia don in the city hunting me down? How many different ways do you think I can do my hair? I refuse to be a redhead. I draw the line there. As much as I like color, I have no desire to paint my head orange. He laughed. Unguarded humor was such a rare expression to see on that chiseled, urbane face that I blinked, staring.
Funny, Miss Lane, he said.
Then he added,
Would you like to drive?
Huh? I gaped. What was wrong with him? Ever since I'd come down at shortly after 11, wearing Fiona's disturbing dress, when I'd first slipped it over my head, I'd waited a few seconds to see if it was laced with some awful poison that would make me itch my skin off. He had been acting like this, and I just didn't get it. He seemed, well, playful, for lack of a better word, in high spirits, almost drunk, though with a clear head. If he were any other man, I might have suspected him of substance abuse, of being coked up or something. But Barons was too much a purist for that. His drugs were money, power, and control. Still, he was so electrically alive tonight that the air around him seemed to crackle and hiss.
Just kidding, he said.
And that was out of character, too. Jericho Barons didn't indulge in humor. That wasn't nice. I've dreamed of driving a Lamborghini.
Can't say cunta, Miss Lane?
With his unplaceable accent, cunta came out sounding even more foreign. Can, I said irritably. Won't. Mom taught me better. He slanted me a sideways look.
And why is that, Miss Lane?
Cussing in any language is still cussing, I said primly. I knew what Countach meant. My dad was the one that got me addicted to fast cars. I'd been a little girl of 7 when he'd begun dragging me from one exotic car show to the next, in lieu of a son to share his passion with. Over the years, we'd developed a deep bond over our love of all things fast and shiny. The Italian Countach was the near equivalent of holy fucking cow in English, which was exactly how I felt every time I saw one, but that was still no reason to say it out loud. If I managed to hold on to nothing else in the midst of the insanity my life had become, at least I could maintain my dignity and decorum.
You seem to know your cars, Miss Lane,
Barons murmured. Some, I said modestly. It was the only thing modest about me at the moment. We had just begun crossing the first of two sets of railroad tracks, and my bosom jiggled in, or rather mostly out, of my revealing dress like it was made of molded jello. Okay, so sometimes I could maintain my dignity and decorum. At other times, it seemed half of Dublin was going to see my breasts up close and personal, although I did derive some comfort from the thought that when I'd done my impromptu strip for the Death by Sex Fae yesterday, I was pretty certain no one else had seen me, thanks to the glamour it had been throwing. We were about to hit the second set of tracks, so I folded my arms in an attempt to hold myself still. As we crossed them, I could feel the weight of Barnes's gaze on my bosom, the heat of it, and I knew without even looking that he had that raw, hungry look on his face again. I refused to glance his way, and we rode for several miles in silence, with him using up entirely too much room in the car, and a weird tension eating up what little space there was between us. "Seen the new Gallardo spider?" I blurted finally.
"No,"
he said instantly.
"Why don't you tell me about it, Miss Lane?"
The playful edge in his voice was gone. It was guttural, tight. I pretended not to notice and began waxing poetical about the V-10 with its razor-sharp lines and 512 horses that, although it couldn't beat the Porsche 911 turbo in a 0-60 speed test, it still packed a flashy, muscular punch, and before I knew it we were pulling up in front of O'Banion's and waiting while valets cleared space for us between a Maybach sedan and a limo. They were human, not rhino boys, which made for a nice change. I confess I left fingerprints on the Maybach. I had to pet it as I walked by, if only to be able to tell Dad I'd touched one. If I'd been living another life, one where Alina hadn't been killed and I wasn't currently up to my neck in nightmares, I would have rung him up on my cell phone right then and there and described the twin-turbo V12 57S touring sedan for those who want to drive their own Maybach, right down to the interior trim done in black piano lacquer finish that gleamed in exquisite contrast to an abundance of creamy leather. He would have excitedly demanded more details. And couldn't I go to the nearest drugstore and buy a disposable camera, or 10? But Alina had been killed. My parents were still off the deep end, and calling Dad right now would have served no purpose. I knew, because I had called home earlier, after I'd finished getting dressed. 10:45 Dublin time was still early evening in Georgia. I'd sat on the edge of my borrowed bed, staring down at stockings that were hooked to an embarrassment of a garter belt, spiky high heels, and the egg-sized blood-red ruby nestled between my breasts, and wondered what I was becoming. Dad had been drunk when he'd answered. I had not heard him drunk in years, 6 1/2 to be exact. Not since his brother had died on the way to his own wedding, leaving his bride-to-be a pregnant widow, and my dad standing at the altar, best man to a dead man. I'd hung up as soon as I'd heard Dad's deeply slurred voice, unable to deal with it. I needed a rock, not to have to be one for someone else.
"Wits about you, Miss Lane,"
Barnes cautioned, close to my ear, jerking me from the dark place I'd been about to get lost in.
"You'll need them here."
With his left arm around my waist, his right hand on my shoulder, fingers lightly brushing the swell of my breast, he steered me toward the entrance, locking gazes with any man brave or stupid enough to let his gaze dip below my eyes, holding it until the man looked away. He could not have more clearly branded me his possession. As soon as we entered the bar, I understood. That was what the women were here, beautiful, impeccably waxed, coiffed and groomed, softly laughing, brightly dazzling possessions. Trophies. They weren't people in and of themselves, but reflections upon their men. As tightly guarded as they were lavishly cosseted, they sparkled and shined like glittering white diamonds, showing the world what successes their husbands were, what giants among men. Rainbow Mac would have been as out of place here as a porcupine in a petting zoo. I straightened my spine, held my head high, and pretended that 2/3 of my supple young body wasn't exposed by the short, sleek black dress with the bare back and plunging neckline. Barron's was known here. As we passed, nods were exchanged and greetings were murmured, and all was soft and lovely at O'Banion's, if you were careful not to notice the steel every man in the room was packing. I leaned close to whisper my next question up at Barron's ear. Even with heels on, he was a head taller than me. "Do you have a gun on you somewhere?" I really hoped he did. His lips quirked, brushing my hair when he replied,
"A gun would only get you killed faster in a place like this, Miss Lane. Don't worry, I don't plan to piss anyone off."
He nodded to a short, cigar-chomping, enormously fat man with a beautiful woman on each mammoth arm.
"Not yet, anyway,"
he murmured after we'd passed. We took a booth in back where he ordered dinner and drinks for both of us. "How do you know I like my steak medium well?" I demanded. "Or that I wanted a Caesar salad? You didn't even ask."
"Look around and learn, Miss Lane. There's not a waiter in here that will take an order from a woman. At O'Banion's you eat what is chosen for you, whether you like it or not."
"Welcome to a time gone by, Miss Lane, when men provided and women accepted. And if they didn't like it, they pretended they did."
"Wow. And I thought the Deep South was bad. Fortunately, I liked my steak anywhere from rare to medium well, could eat just about any kind of salad, and was thrilled to have someone else springing for an expensive meal, so I made short work of it. All I'd eaten today was two bowls of cereal, and I was starved. When I finished, I saw Barron's plate was still nearly full, and raised a brow. He pushed it toward me.
"I ate earlier," he said.
"So why'd you order, then?" I asked as daintily as I could around a bite of rare filet mignon.
"You don't go to an O'Banion business and not spend money," Barron said.
"Sounds like he's got a lot of stupid rules," I muttered. Just then a barrel of a man with big knuckled hands, a flattened nose, and cauliflowered ears approached.
"Good to see you again, Mr. Barron's. Mr. O'Banion invites you and your companion to drop by the back and say hello."
It wasn't really an invitation, and no one pretended it was. Barron's rose immediately, collected me, tucked me into his body again, and steered me along behind the battered ex-boxer, as if, without guidance, I might blindly bounce off walls a short-circuited Stepford wife. I was going to be really glad to get out of this place. By the back meant another building quite some distance behind the pub. We got there underground, following O'Banion's man through the kitchens, down a long flight of stairs, and into a well-lit, damp stone tunnel. As we hurried past openings to more tunnels that were either blocked up with stone and concrete or sealed by heavily padlocked steel doors, Barron's murmured close to my ear,
"In some parts of Dublin, there's another city beneath the city."
"Creepy," I muttered, as we ascended another long flight of stairs. I guess I was expecting something out of a movie. A pack of dissolute, heavy-jowled men crammed into a smoke-filled room, gathered around a table, wearing sweat-stained shirts and gun holsters, chewing cigars and playing high-stakes poker with centerfolds of naked women tacked to the walls. What I got was a dozen or so well-dressed men talking quietly in a spacious, handsomely appointed room of mahogany and leather, and the only woman on the walls here was the Madonna with child. But the Madonna wasn't alone. The august room was virtually wallpapered with religious icons, interspersed with built-in bookcases graced by collections of Bibles that I suspected might even make the Pope covetous, hung crucifixes of silver, gold, wood, and even one of those glow-in-the-dark plastic ones. Behind a stately desk hung a series of 12 paintings depicting Christ's last moments. Over the fireplace was a reproduction of the Last Supper. At the far end of the room were two prayer shrines covered with brightly flickering candles, flanking a larger shrine that held an elaborate antique reliquary containing heaven's only knew what. Perhaps the tooth or heel bone of some obscure saint. A powerfully built, dark-haired man stood before the ancient religious chasse, his back to us. I pretended to stumble at the threshold of the door. Barron's caught me. "Oops," I said meaningfully. Though we'd not agreed on a code, I thought saying oops was pretty clear. I was telling him there was an object of power somewhere nearby. Not in this room, but close. From the sudden acid in my stomach that seemed to be boiling up through the soles of my feet, I suspected whatever it was lay directly beneath us, in Barron's city beneath the city. If Barron's got my not-so-subtle message, he gave no sign of it. His eyes were focused on the man at the shrine, his jaw set. As the man turned from the reliquary, the two unseely flanking him turned also. Whoever the big, bad Unseely was that was after the Shisadu, he'd stationed his watchdogs here, too. Our unknown competitor was watching the same people Barron's was interested in, McCabe, Malouche, and now O'Banion. Unlike the rhino boys at McCabe's and Malusha's, however, these were casting no glamour of being human whatsoever, which perplexed me until I realized that they really had no need. In their natural state, they were invisible to everyone but she-seers like Barons and me, and we seemed a pretty rare breed. I had no idea why these rhino boys had chosen to remain invisible rather than inserting themselves into O'Banion's tangible reality as others had done with McCabe and Malouche, but they had, which meant I had to determinedly not look at them at all. At least when Unseelie were faking passing as humans, I could notice whatever illusion they were presenting and not give myself away. But when they weren't, I didn't dare observe the space they occupied, which was easier said than done. Sliding your gaze over something that looks so alien is a little tricky. I took a cue from Barons and focused my attention on the man between them who was, no doubt, Rocky O'Banion. I could instantly see how he'd gotten where he was. In any century, this man would have been a fighter, a leader of men. Dark, brawny, 6 feet of graceful, glistening muscle in black trousers, a white shirt, and a fine, soft Italian-made black leather jacket, he moved with the confidence of a man who knew his slightest wish was the rest of the world's command. His short black hair was thick, his teeth the perfect white of an ex-boxer with money, and when he smiled, which he did now at Barron's, it was lightning quick and full of dark Irish deviltry.
"Good to see you again, Barons."
Barons nodded.
"O'Banion, what brings you here tonight?"
Barons murmured something complimentary about the pub, and then the two men moved swiftly into a conversation about recent trouble O'Banion had been having at one of his shipping concerns down by the docks. Barons had heard something out on the street that might be useful, he said. I watched them while they talked. Rocky O'Banion was a lodestone, 6 feet of pure muscle-packed charisma. He was the kind of man men wanted to be and women wanted to be dragged off to bed by, and I did mean dragged off. There would be no dominating this man by any woman. There was no doubt in my mind that the powerful, ruggedly attractive Irishman with the stone-hewn jaw was also a stone-cold killer, and from the way he was trying to pave his way to heaven by plastering over his sins with a putty of religious zeal, he was also a borderline psychopath. Yet none of it diminished my attraction to him one bit. That was the true measure of the man's presence. I was revolted by him, and at the same time, if he were to focus that devilish Irish charm my way, if those dark, heavy-lidded eyes would turn with favor in my direction, I was afraid I would flush with pleasure, even as I knew I should be running as fast as I could the other way. And for that reason alone, the man scared the living bejesus out of me. I was surprised to notice that Barons didn't look much more comfortable than I, and that worried me even more. Nothing disturbed Jericho Barons, yet I could clearly see tension in the angles of his body and strain in the lines of his face, around the mouth and eyes. Every bit of earlier playfulness in him was gone. He was lean, mean, and hard again, even seemed a little pale beneath that exotic golden skin. Though he stood inches taller than our host and was even more powerfully built, though he usually exuded comparable vitality and presence, at the moment he seemed diminished, and I got the sudden, weirdest impression that 99% of Jericho Barons was currently focused somewhere else and being nearly used up, leaving only 1% of him here and now in this room paying attention to O'Banion.
"Beautiful woman, Jericho,"
O'Banion said then, turning his gaze, as I'd feared, my way. And as I'd feared, I blushed. The boxer stepped closer, circled me, looking me up and down, and made a rough sound of masculine approval in the back of his throat.
"She is, isn't she?"
Barons replied.
"Not Irish,"
O'Banion observed.
"American. Catholic? Protestant,"
Barons said. I didn't bat an eyelash at the lie.
"Too bad."
Rocky turned his attention back to Barons, and I breathed again.
"Good to see you, Jericho. If you should hear anything further about my troubles at the dock, I'll be in touch,"
said Barons. "You like him," I said later, as we picked our way back through the nearly deserted 4 a.m. streets of downtown Dublin. The information Behrens had given him had actually been pertinent, identifying several members of a local gang as the thorns in O'Banion's side.
"No, Miss Lane,"
Behrens replied. "Okay, maybe not like," I corrected. "Respect. You respect O'Banion." Again, Behrens shook his head. "Well, what then?" Behrens had accorded Rocky O'Banion a certain solemn distance he'd not shown any of the others, and I wanted to know why. He thought a moment.
"If I were in the middle of Afghanistan's mountains and could choose either one man to fight bare-handed by my side or a full complement of sophisticated weapons, I'd take O'Banion. I neither like nor respect him. I merely recognize what he is."
We hurried along for a few blocks in silence. I was grateful to be out of the stilettos I'd worn earlier and back in comfortable shoes. When we'd left O'Banion's, Behrens had whisked us back to the bookstore, where he'd demanded a full report of what I'd sensed. After I'd told him, he'd left me alone in the bookstore while he'd gone off by himself somewhere to get reacquainted with some of the finer points of the city's sewage system, he'd said. In his absence, I'd gone upstairs and changed. I could figure out proper sewer-crawling attire all by myself, something old, dark, and grungy. We'd returned to the general vicinity of O'Banion's pub and restaurant in a dark, nondescript sedan I'd never have noticed parked in the shadowy rear of Behrens's fascinating garage, left it at the curb several blocks from our intended destination, and hoofed it from there.
"Stay here a minute."
A hand on my shoulder, Behrens stopped me on the sidewalk, then strode into the middle of the street. He was his usual self again, occupying more space than was his due. He had changed, too, into faded jeans, a black T-shirt, and scuffed black boots. It was the first time I'd ever seen him in something so, well, plebeian for him, and the hard, muscled body those clothes showcased was nothing short of incredible, if you went for that kind of man. Thankfully, I didn't. It was like seeing a powerful, stalking black panther, blood frothing its muzzle, wearing street clothes. Very weird. "You've got to be kidding me," I said, when shoulders bunching and biceps bulging. He lifted the manhole cover, slid it aside, and beckoned me.
"How did you think we were going to get into the sewer system, Miss Lane?"
Behrens said impatiently. I didn't. I must have purposely bypassed that thought. I walked over. "Are you sure there's not a convenient flight of stairs around here somewhere?" He shrugged.
"There is. It's not, however, the best point of access."
He glanced up at the sky.
"We need to get in and out as quickly as possible, Miss Lane."
I understood that. In very little time it would be dawn, and the streets in Dublin began bustling with people as early as daybreak. It would hardly do to come popping out of a manhole right in front of them, or worse, inches from a car's front bumper. I stood over the open hole in the street and peered down into the darkness. "Rats," I said, a bit sadly.
"Undoubtedly."
"Right." I took a deep breath and blew it out slowly. "Shades?"
"Not enough to feed on down there. They prefer the streets. Take my hand, and I'll lower you down, Miss Lane."
"How will we get back up?" I worried.
"I have a different route in mind for our return trip."
"Does it involve stairs?" I asked hopefully.
"No."
"Of course not. How silly of me. And for our return adventure," I said in my best game show announcer voice, "we will be scaling the side of Mount Everest, hiking boots to be provided by our trusty sponsor, Behrens Books and Baubles."
"Amusing, Miss Lane."
Behrens could not have looked more unamused.
"Now move."
I took his outthrust hand, let him dangle me over the edge, and drop me down. Destination? A darker, even scarier Dublin, deep underground. 16. It turned out not to be so scary after all. In fact, not nearly as scary as Upside had been lately. Down there, in the dreary, dirty sewers beneath the city, I realized how drastically my world had changed, and in such a small amount of time. How could a beady-eyed, twitchy-nosed rat, or even a few hundred, compare to the gray man? What consequence raw sewage and stench next to one's likely fate at the hands of the many-mouthed thing? What significance ruined shoes or nails torn scrabbling over rocks in collapsing parts of the city's underbelly when measured against the brazen theft I was about to commit? Against a man who'd taken out 27 people in a single night just because they were in the way of his bright and shining future, no less. We turned one way, then the next, through empty tunnels with unobstructed walkways into ones fouled by slow-moving sludge. We sloped down deeper into the earth, veered up, and descended again. What is that? I pointed to a wide stream of fast-moving water, visible beyond an iron grill mounted in the wall. We'd passed many such grills, though smaller and set lower into the walls. Most were affixed in sunken spots, with large pools of black water collected around them, but I'd seen nothing like this. This looked like a river. It was.
The River Poddle, Baron said. It runs underground. You can see where it meets the River Liffey through another such grill at the Millennium Bridge. In the late 18th century, two rebel leaders escaped Dublin Castle by following the sewer system to it. One can navigate the city fairly well if one knows where things connect.
And you do, I said.
I do, he agreed.
Is there anything you don't know? Ancient artifacts, how to freeze obscenely large bank accounts, the seedy subculture of the city, not to mention the exact layout of its dark, dirty underbelly?
Not much.
I could discern no arrogance in his reply. It was simply fact. How did you learn it all?
When did you become such a chatterbox, Miss Lane?
I shut up. I told you pride is my special little challenge. He didn't want to hear me? Fine. I didn't want to waste my breath on him anyway. Where were you born? I asked. Baron stopped short, turned around and looked at me, as if bewildered by my sudden spate of talkativeness. I raised my hands, bewildered too. I don't know why I asked that. I had every intention of shutting up, but then I started thinking about how I know nothing about you. I don't know where you were born, whether you have parents, siblings, a wife, children, or even exactly what it is you do.
You know all you need to know about me, Miss Lane, as I do about you. Now move. We've precious little time.
A dozen yards later, he motioned me up the rungs of a steel ladder bolted into the wall, and at the top of it, I became instantly deeply nauseated. There was one extremely potent oop, dead ahead. Beyond that, Barons, I said apologetically. I guess we're kind of screwed, huh? That was what looked like a bulkhead door. You know, the kind they use on bank vaults that are several feet thick, made of virtually impenetrable alloys, and open with that big spinning wheel thing like on submarine doors. It was just too bad the handle wasn't on our side. Don't suppose you have a convenient stash of explosives on you somewhere, I joked. I was tired and afraid, and I was getting a little slap-happy, or maybe it was just the general ever-increasing absurdity of my life that was making it difficult for me to take anything too seriously. Barons eyed the massive door a moment, then closed his eyes. I could actually see the internal analysis he was performing. His eyes moved rapidly beneath closed lids, as if scanning the blueprints of Dublin's sanitation system as they flashed across his retinas, Terminator-style, while he targeted our exact position and searched for a point of entry. His eyes flew open.
You're sure it's beyond that door?
I nodded. Absolutely. I could puke right here.
Try to restrain yourself, Miss Lane.
He turned and began walking away.
Remain here.
I stiffened. Where are you going? A single flashlight suddenly seemed grossly inadequate company.
He's counting on natural barriers to protect it.
Barons tossed over his shoulder.
I'm a strong swimmer.
I watched his flashlight bob as he hurried down a tunnel to my left and disappeared around a corner. Then there was nothing but blackness, and I was alone in it, with only two batteries standing between myself and a serious case of the heebie-jeebies. I hate the dark. I didn't used to, but I sure do now. It felt like hours, although according to my watch it was only 7.5 minutes later that a dripping wet Barons opened the bulkhead door. "Oh, God, what is this place?" I said, turning in a slow circle, transfixed. We were in a rough-hewn stone chamber that was crammed with yet more religious artifacts displayed side by side with ancient weapons. It was evident from the high water marks on the stone that the subterranean structure flooded occasionally, but all of O'Banion's treasures were mounted well above the highest, suspended on brackets bolted into the walls, or displayed on top of tall stone pedestals. I could just see the dark, handsome, psychopathic ex-boxer standing here, gloating over his treasures, the frightening gleam of religious fanaticism in his heavy-lidded eyes. Wet footprints led from an iron grate low in the wall, beyond which lay deep black water, straight to the door. Barons hadn't even paused to look around when he'd entered.
"Find it, get it, and let's go,"
Barons barked. I'd forgotten he couldn't know which item it was, only I could. I turned in a slow circle, stretching my newfound spidey sense. I retched, dryly. Fortunately, it seemed I was getting a little better at this. My supper stayed in my stomach. I had a sudden vision of O'Banion coming down to discover his artifact missing, with neat little piles of puke all over the place, and wondered what he would make of it. I snickered, a measure of how completely freaked out I was. "That." I pointed to an item mounted just above my head, almost lost amid the assortment of similar items surrounding it, and turned to look at Barons, who was standing behind me, just outside the bulkhead door. He was staring down the corridor. Now he turned slowly and glanced in.
"Fuck!"
he exploded, punching the door.
"I didn't even see it."
Then louder.
"Fuck!"
He turned away. His back to me, he snapped.
"Are you sure that's it?"
"Absolutely."
"Well, get it, Miss Lane. Don't just stand there."
I blinked. "Me?"
"You're standing right next to it."
"But it makes me feel sick," I protested.
"Now's the perfect time to start working on that little problem of yours. Get it."
Stomach heaving all the while, I lifted the thing from the wall. The metal bracket suspending it popped up with an audible click when I removed its weight. "Now what?" I said. Barons laughed, and the sound echoed hollowly off the stone.
"Now, Miss Lane, we run like hell, because you just set off a dozen alarms."
I jerked. "What are you talking about? I don't hear anything."
"Silent. Straight to every house he owns. Depending on where he is at the moment, we have little or even less time."
Barons wasn't turning out to be a good influence on me at all. In a single night, he'd gotten me to dress like a floozy, burgle like a common thief, and now he had me cussing like a sailor as I seconded his opinion. "Fuck!" I exclaimed. It occurred to me as I raced through the pre-dawn streets of Dublin, with a spear longer than I was tucked beneath my arm, that I didn't expect to live much longer.
"Lose the pessimism, Miss Lane,"
Barons said when I informed him of my thoughts.
"It's a self-fulfilling prophecy."
"Huh?" I said, gasping for breath. I tried to fling myself into the car, but succeeded only in getting wedged in the open door by the spear.
"Slide it over the top of the seat and into the back," he barked.
I managed to unjam myself and did just that. I had to roll the window down so part of the shaft could protrude. Barons slid behind the wheel at the same moment I dropped into the passenger seat, and we both slammed our doors.
"Expect to die," he said, "and you will. The power of thought is far greater than most people ever realize."
He started the car and pulled away from the curb.
"Fuck,"
he said again. It seemed to be the word of the night. A Garda car was passing us, moving very slowly. Fortunately, it was on Barons' side, not mine, and the cop couldn't see the butt of the spear sticking out. "We're not doing anything wrong," I said instantly. "Well, I mean, not that he knows, right? Surely the alarm hasn't been reported to the police yet, has it?"
"Whether or not it has, he just got a good look at us, Miss Lane. We're on O'Banion turf. Who do you think pays to have his streets patrolled at these hours?"
Understanding dawned slowly. You're saying that even if the cop doesn't know now, once he finds out O'Banion was robbed, I trailed off.
He'll pass on our descriptions,
Behrens finished for me. We're dead, I said matter-of-factly.
There's that pessimism again,
said Behrens. Realism. I'm talking about reality here, Behrens. Pull your head out. What do you think O'Banion's going to do to us when he finds out? Give us a little slap on the wrist?
This is the end of disc number 5. Please continue listening on disc number 6.